Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. This country has moved in epic periods of three quarters of a century at a time. The nation's founding, the Civil War, Jim Crow, the Civil Rights Movement. Well, Bob Moses said that a couple of years ago, and the thread he draws through U.S. history would put the nation right on the event horizon of another epic period. So, Mr. Moses, he's on the line with us right now. Would you agree? Is the country poised right now to enter another epic period, to possibly even lurch forward? What do you think?
So, thanks so much, Meghna, for having me on. We are in such a period. We are lurching. The issue is which way are we going to lurch? And in the other periods, we lurch forward only to lurch backward some. I mean, I think the net result was a lurch forward in some respects, but also a refashioning of what had been going on so that there was also a lurch back, right?
Right.
And
well,
this
can I just jump in here?
Please.
Mr. Moses, if I may, and forgive me for interrupting, but I wanted to just tell people why we're so thrilled that you could join us on the program today and why we really wanted to hear what your thoughts are about this this time that we're living in, because for folks who don't know, Bob Moses was a key figure in that last epical phase of U.S. history. He is a legendary civil rights activist. He was a field secretary for the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, or SNCC, and he had already been working on civil and voting rights in Mississippi in the early 60s, when in 1964, he organized the Freedom Summer there, and that was the historic voter registration and education movement that was met with a great deal of resistance and violence. I mean, for example, Mr. Moses, I was reading back on the things that you experienced during that time. You were shot at, you were imprisoned, you were beaten for your efforts there. And I was remembering a story that there was a time that you were beaten so badly that you were bleeding from your head, but you stood up anyway and continued walking to a county courthouse in Mississippi. And you were still bleeding from your head when you entered the courthouse and told the clerk there that the two men who were with you wanted to register to vote. So that is the person here that we wanted to invite to the show to give us a sense as to of history and where we are now. And I'm so glad you could join us. But forgive me for interrupting. I wanted to say all that. Do you think that we're poised to lurch forward, or are you concerned that there could be a lurching backward now?
Yes. So to be poised to lurch forward, the country has to come to grips with its constitution, I think, basically. The path that we followed as a country was laid down in the constitution in 1787. The two pieces, really, the preamble and Article 4, Section 2, Paragraph 3. So those two pieces of the Constitution lay out classes of constitutional people, right? The preamble says, well, these are the constitutional people who ordain and establish this Constitution. And as we know, they were white men who owned property. Article 4, Section 2, Paragraph 3 says something about not only what kind of property they may own, but who. And so we have a class of constitutional people who are Africans, and they are the property of the former, of the preamble people. And you mentioned Freedom Summer. So Freedom Summer was an attempt in the broadest sense, to look at the preamble and to say to sharecroppers in Mississippi, African-American sharecroppers in Mississippi, you are constitutional people and you are part of the United States as constitutional people, right? It's an attempt to broaden the reach of the preamble, an attempt to break down the caste system, basically, that all the lurches, right, the Civil War and then the Civil Rights Movement, somehow the caste system is so deeply ingrained, and I think it's ingrained in the beginning of the Constitution, that we have not really been able. The issue that's really interesting now and at stake is the recognition that we actually are running a caste system, right? Mm-hmm. Now, Conant, you remember James Conant, he was president of Harvard, right, from 33 to 53. And when he left, he went to Germany, came back and wrote a book, Slums and Suburbs. So he took a look at slums, what he called slum schools and suburban schools, high schools, right? And what he said was that, well, the country, with agreement from all of its congresspeople, you know, presidents, so forth, set up a caste system after the Civil War. And what he hadn't himself come to really understand and appreciate was that the clearest manifestation of the caste system was the education system. Now, don't get confused, people. It's not that the education system is the caste system. No, we have a caste system and it's manifested in our education system, but it's manifested all over the place. And we were...
Go ahead. So you're going to have to forgive me if it sounds like I'm interrupting you a lot, because I do want to draw from as much of your experience as I possibly can. So if I could, I just want to play a little bit of an excerpt of a young Bob Moses in the 1960s, in 1964. This is from a PBS documentary called Freedom Summer. And here you are describing the work that you were doing in 1964 as a part of SNCC in Mississippi.
Young people working with the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, or SNCC as we call it, are characterized by restless energy. They seek radical change in race relations in the United States. Their world is upset, and they feel that if they are ever going to get it straight, they must upset it more.
So that was a young Bob Moses featured in the PBS documentary Freedom Summer. Now, I read, Mr. Moses, that also at the same time, while you called for the obligation to perhaps upset people out of their complacency, you had also said of the efforts of activists across the Freedom Summer in Mississippi that, quote, maybe we're not going to get many people registered this summer. Maybe even we're not going to get very many people into freedom schools. Maybe all we're going to do is live this summer. In Mississippi, that will be so much. So can you talk about that today, about balancing the need for pointed and directed change with the reality of the situation in that particular historical moment? Does that echo in the streets of America today?
Yes. So, of course, the issue there were the almost 1,000 volunteers, almost all of them white college students, coming down to Mississippi. And really understanding that their job was not to somehow overturn voter registration in Mississippi. Their job was to bring the country into Mississippi and also to bring Mississippi into the country. And they could do that individually as a collective group by just living with African-American people in Mississippi who were struggling themselves, right, against this caste system, right? So just the act of living, right, they didn't have to do, we weren't asking them to do something courageous, right? What was courageous was just going there and living with African-American people and experiencing their lives, right? It was a shock to some of them that they couldn't walk downtown. Yeah, they're in what they think is America, but it was dangerous, you know, just to walk downtown, right? So here we are now. In this situation, where for the first time, I think, the larger, or at least a large segment of the larger population, it hit home to them with that video of George Floyd, that, and this policeman, that we are living in a country that we don't know, right? We did not really understand the country we are living in.
Well, Bob Moses, stand by for just a moment because we have to take a quick break here. We're listening to legendary civil rights activist Bob Moses about whether, once again, the United States is at the edge of what could be an epical moment in this country's history. When we come back, we'll also bring into the conversation Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Taylor Branch. Stay with us. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This hour, we're asking whether the United States is in the moment or at the beginning of a moment of what could be epical change in this country's history. And we're exploring that question with an activist and, in a moment, a chronicler of the last moment where the United States underwent a sea change as a nation. Bob Moses is with us. He is the legendary civil rights activist. And I now want to bring into the conversation, if I could, Taylor Branch. He is the Pulitzer Prize-winning historian, author of many books, including the trilogy America in the King Years. Taylor Branch, welcome to On Point.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
So you, I'm looking forward to hearing both you and Bob talk with each other about how the two of you see this moment. But let me just get us started here by asking you, you know, Bob had he was talking to us about the 75-year cycle, roughly, that he sees of epic change in this country. Not that long ago, you actually told one of our producers when she was a student in North Carolina that you kind of know when the country is going through a moment like that, when everyone feels like their teeth are getting rattled. And you really felt that in 1968, for example. In 2020, is this a tooth-rattling moment for us all in the United States?
Well, I think it could be. I think it's in the early stages. I think as in the early civil rights period, when people were galvanized by certain images, like the image of Emmett Till in his casket, or some of the images from the freedom rides and sit-ins, or children being marching into dogs and fire hoses in Birmingham, that today the images like George Floyd have really galvanized and broke down through a lot of people's resistance. But I still think it's the early stages, and I agree with Bob. We don't know exactly how it's going to lurch. I think it's too early to tell. I think from the last one, the only point I would offer, and I defer to Bob on all of these things. I've been studying him for 40 years almost. I think from the last lurch, it went simultaneously forward and backward, in the sense that we're still reaping some of the benefits that the Black-led civil rights movement set in motion by really breaking through to the country on what equal citizenship meant and does mean. It opened doors for women, we had never had a female rabbi in 2,000 years until the civil rights movement started raising those questions within Judaism. Gay rights didn't exist. So empirically, I think we're still reaping benefits from that period, but our politics, our political discourse has lurched backward in cynicism about what government can do, that's largely driven underneath it by tribal racism. I don't want the government that's going to put me in concert with different kinds of people. So I think that kind of politics may have run its course. President Trump kind of epitomized the tribal reaction, backlash politics, and positioned us for a lurch forward in politics, too. But my overall belief is that we don't know yet, and I'd be very interested whether what other signs beyond the energy and the reaction to the images that Bob sees that may take hold here, so that we can have some footholds in history to turn us in a better place.
Yeah. So let me ask a question of both of you. This issue that Taylor said that the benefits of the civil rights movement have accrued to a wide range of categories of people, right? But not to young Black men. And I just want us to think about in what I think of as the first constitutional era, from 1787, say, to roughly around 1865, Africans were not in jail. They were property. You did not park your property, right? You used it, right? And so they did not go to jail. In the second era, right, Circular 3591, right, Attorney General Biddle, right, on December 12th, right, 5 days after Pearl Harbor, he's instructed by Roosevelt to issue this circular, which says, look, you got to stop the business of arresting young Black men for vagrancy and sending them away, in effect, to another form of slavery. And so he wrote that circular to every state or county prosecuting attorney, and brought to an end what Black men in his book, Slavery by Another Name, brought to our attention, right? The rounding up of young Black men, not just Black men and women and families on plantations, but young Black men into the mines. And now here we are, and we are the young Black men in prison, right? There are no jobs for them. We did not, and we still refuse to educate them, and they have no safety net, right? And so they are going to prison, and we can defund every single police department in this country. But if the kids don't get an education which is appropriate for the century in which they are growing up and have to live, they will be part still of this mass incarceration. So we went from nobody in jail, put them in jail in the mines, to put them in jail in the jails, right? And they are in the jails, you know, they're there working to create masks and or whatever, right, for the population that's out. So we, I just want to put that out on the table as to where we are, in my opinion.
Well, yeah, so, and Taylor Branch, I'll let you respond to Bob Moses in a second, but if I could just answer your question with a question, Mr. Moses. I mean, education was part of your work that the Freedom Summer tried to accomplish, right? Because there were the Freedom Schools there in Mississippi that were founded. And since then, you've been heavily involved also in education with the Algebra Project, trying to bring mathematical education to underserved students. So with your raising of this question, though, what is it that you would tell activists today who are out on American streets calling for the defunding of police departments, for example?
Fine. They should defund police departments. But they should not think that funding the police departments and doing something with that dimension of the caste system is going to impact the manifestation of the caste system in our education system. And here, there's a lesson from the 60s. The 57 Civil Rights Act created the Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department and created an Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights. And it created them and gave them permission, right, to work directly with people who had the problem. In this case, African Americans across the southern part of the United States, right? And they, therefore, it didn't matter what the state of Mississippi said, right? In some sense, they were committed to working directly with African Americans who wanted to vote, right? Now, do we need such a thing? That's what I would say to the activists. We need a similar arrangement for education. We need something from the federal government, which is going to be able to go directly to the students that, in my mind, are getting the 21st century version of sharecropper education, right? And we need to be able to directly invest in the opportunity structures. We've invested in the accountability structures, right? Testing them nonstop. But without any opportunity structures in place for their teachers, for their students, right? For their administrators and the school system as a whole. That's what one step that has to be, and I would put that out to activists. So we are working with Jamaria, who is one of the young people in the Detroit case, right? To see if we can begin that kind of organizing, you know, around this issue.
Mm-hmm. Well, Taylor Branch, go ahead, jump back in here.
Well, I think what you're hearing from Bob is a diagnosis of the depth of racial injustice that has always been far beyond conscious realization in American history, and yet at the same time, Bob is reaching deep for constitutional roots that might address the problem. A constitutional right to education. You know, that's the great paradox here. Bob and I discovered in common in our public talks these days, we often begin or end by reciting the preamble to the Constitution, which is breathtaking in its audacity, and says, "We the people." It doesn't say, "We the property-owning white people." So you don't throw out the Constitution just by saying it was written by slaveholders or they didn't really mean what they said. It is where we can search for things like an educational, a right to education that's appropriate and that can change this country, or for that matter, an affirmative right to vote in the Constitution. They didn't put that in when they wrote the 15th Amendment because they were afraid it would apply to women and Chinese workers on the Transcontinental Railroad. So the 15th Amendment is written negatively to apply only to men and prohibit discrimination on the basis of color or condition or previous condition of servitude. So there are basic fundamental things that a new movement to move us forward would be struggling with that do have a constitutional base. And when you see that kind of struggle going on among the people Bob is talking about, it will be a positive sign that all of the energy that's opening up this education can connect to something in our constitutional heritage that will shove people or allow them to go forward. Remember that he said the Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department was created in the 1950s, just in time for the Civil Rights Movement. The Justice Department itself was created in 1870 specifically to enforce the 15th Amendment, giving black men at the time the right to vote. Before that, the Attorney General had just been, an advisor to the president. So we have deep in our history an unrecognized pattern that we wrestle with constitutional questions when we're dealing with race.
So let me come back to something, though, that I can't quite let this go just yet, that maybe I'm hearing a note of caution in both of your voices, and that caution is born by experience, which is what we want to learn from today. And at the same time, though, here we have this moment this year in American history where not only with the protests nationwide that followed the killing of George Floyd, but we have layered over that this pandemic as well, which both together make it inescapable, make the inequities of America inescapable for anyone who, if they didn't have their eyes open before, perhaps now if they dared open their eyes, they cannot see anything but the evidence everywhere of fundamental inequities in American society. Is not just even that sort of mass realization, or even if people don't realize it, that mass confrontation with this truth about American society, is that not enough to make this one of those epical moments? We don't know which direction it's going to break, but certainly it lends itself to the possibility of some kind of great change. Bob Moses, don't you think so?
Yes. I mean, it lends itself to that. And I actually think that for a great many people in this country, that happened. They woke up to understand that the country they thought they knew was not exactly their country. You can contrast that image with the image of the Sheriff Rainey in Neshoba County. I don't know if you remember that image on Life magazine, the front cover. They're at their arraignment or some legal proceedings, and they're sitting up there with bag lunch, eating and laughing, right? And this goes out to the whole country, right? Because Life magazine is what people are reading, right? So, but they look at that and they say, that's not us, right? There's no way they can see themselves in Sheriff Rainey, right? So the switch from that to looking at this police officer and his intrepid, gaze, right, straightforward, right? The impunity of it struck people. That's us too. We're not him, but we have allowed the conditions that produce him and the kind of actions that he does. But the country didn't think that about Sheriff Rainey. They didn't think that they had allowed the conditions for Sheriff Rainey to become what he became and to murder those civil rights workers. They didn't think that that was part of their problem. That was part of those people's problem. So it's a big difference.
And just to underscore the history you mentioned, Sheriff Rainey, Lawrence Rainey in Neshoba County, Mississippi, that was the same county in which activists James Chaney, Andrew Goodman, and Michael Schwerner, as you just mentioned, were murdered just days after the beginning of the Freedom Summer in 1964 in Mississippi. So, Taylor Branch, I'm going to get your answer to that same question when we come back after a quick break. We are talking with legendary civil rights activist Bob Moses and Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Taylor Branch about whether we are at the precipice of another epical moment in U.S. history. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This hour, we're listening to Bob Moses and Taylor Branch talk us through whether the United States is at a pivot point in its history. Bob Moses was a civil rights activist during the last major pivot point in U.S. history. He was field secretary for the Student Nonviolence Coordinating Committee, or SNCC, one of the organizers, primary organizers of the Freedom Summer in Mississippi in 1964. He also helped co-found the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party and is president and founder of the Algebra Project as well. Taylor Branch is a Pulitzer Prize-winning writer and historian, author of several books, including the trilogy America in the King Years. Now, Taylor, before the break, I had asked whether the sheer inescapability of the inequities that have been laid bare in 2020 makes this possibly one of those epical moments. And when we heard Robert Moses' answer, and I'm just wondering how you might answer that question.
Well, I agree. I think it's unquestionably possible that this is a transformative moment. And if it's not, the consequences, I'm afraid, will be dire because the need is so great. And one of the things about COVID is that it has it is so transformational in our daily lives, what we can do, that it has opened up the possibility of major change, you know, in people's everyday life. And all of the energy in the demonstrations is real, but it hasn't taken hold yet in something that can last, focused in the way that Bob mentioned. And we just always need to remind ourselves that the voices are already here that are misremembering, mischaracterizing, even challenging the vocabulary that we're using today, and that's to be expected. It's easy to be cynical and just cuss the government and sneer at things. You can get elected being dumb, and there will be people who would rather be in a tribal white nation than a democratic nation if push come to a shove. So it's not going to be easy. I agree that it is it's a big turning point, and I hope we go forward. But I keep Dr. King recognized and gave a totally ignored speech in 1965 saying that George Wallace, the governor of Alabama had retooled his stump speech for segregation into an ingenious, what he called a minor little classic, saying he had never been a racist, he had never uttered a word that would denigrated black people, and that Wallace's only purpose was to restore local government from the tyranny of big government and tax-and-spend liberals and pointy-headed bureaucrats. And he invented basically the vocabulary of modern politics. So we should be well aware that things like that will be going on now to make the job of restoring this country and addressing the caste system and really advancing equal citizenship in reality, make that job as difficult as possible.
So I just want to emphasize that I'm not saying that looking at history and overlaying it on today, that there will be a one-to-one correlation there, because every movement is also of its time. But for the sake of this conversation, Bob Moses, let me just put it this way. Okay, so if 2020 isn't the analogous, say, 1964, in the civil rights movement, and as Taylor said earlier, maybe the better period for us to think about is the 1950s. What would you say, based on your experience, are the steps that need to be taken now to kind of have the movement gel to a point of effectiveness where perhaps the very policies that you were talking about can get passed, can get codified into law? How do we get there?
Yes, so that's what we don't know, how we get there. My experience, talking about my experience, but my experience was really with the Mississippi Theater of the Civil Rights Movement. Mm-hmm. We didn't do direct action. And here's an important point. We mounted what I think of as an earned insurgency, right? And people bristle about the idea that you have to earn your insurgencies. But first, we had to earn it among the people we were asking to go to register to vote. Why should they risk their lives, their economic livelihoods, their families, to go down on some dream about they're going to be given the right to vote, right? So in the end, we earned their right to do that by a very simple act of getting up every time we got knocked down. So yes, knock us down, but we're going to get back up. And just that act, because there was nothing you could say to Mississippi sharecroppers that was going to convince them that what you were talking about was real, right? What convinced them to work with you was the fact that you went out there and worked, and when you got knocked down, you got back up, and you kept working, right? So that was one group. The other group was equally important, and that was the small group of lawyers at the Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department, maybe a dozen or so, working under John Doe and Burke Marshall, right? Because they actually held the key to the jailhouse doors, right? The Act, the 57 Act said the state couldn't interfere with people trying to register or people trying to help them. So once Nick had decided that all it was going to do in Mississippi was voter registration, then the presumption every time we got arrested was that we were arrested for doing voter registration. But then we had to earn the respect of the Justice Department people because they were not required, right, to go in and get us out of jail, right? They weren't forbidden, but they were not required, right? They were permitted to do that, but that's a judgment call, and they have their other forces, that Senator Eastland and so forth, right? Mm. But in the end, I think we earned their respect for the work we were doing, And so the result was that we could do the work. In other words, every time we got arrested, Mississippi could arrest us. But Mississippi, in this case, didn't hold the jailhouse key, right? Think what happened to the Freedom Riders and direct action. It couldn't happen in Mississippi, right? Because they were faced with long-term jail sentences if they were going to be serious about long-term direct action, right? So nobody was willing to do the Nelson Mandela, right, and stay in jail for, you know, God knows how long, right? And then third, we had to earn the right to call on the rest of the country to come and take a good look at itself, right? And it was only because we were down there doing that work, organizing work, all that time, that we earned the right. So now the country is trying to look at itself, but who are the people that have earned the right to say to the country, look, not that way, this way?
Yeah. Well, Bob Moses, you're right that what you said may not land so welcoming. It may not land with open arms on the ears of many listeners, because I think of one of the natural responses is, well, because of the work of you and civil rights activists in the 60s, that right has been earned, right? And the right to make these demands of the country has been earned. And in fact, when you were talking about you know, who holds the keys to the jail cells, it's that very hand. It's the people who hold those keys that activists are asking to change. So I mean, Taylor Branch, respond to that even that it's the what Bob Moses is saying, while it's absolutely true, perhaps it's not actually seen in the same way by activists today.
Well, I haven't talked with many activists who are discussing the historical context in that depth, as Bob has just gone back through fundamental truths from his experience that really were a vital part of a history that's a lot of people have read my books and followed what he's done, but it's not really part of the everyday vocabulary of how difficult and what a struggle and what a profound intellectual and psychological and courageous struggle that was. So, you know, I don't think there's any disagreement here in the sense that the Freedom Rides and 1960 and the early demonstrations represented a tremendous burst of energy that wound up opening doors. But the next phases went through the kind of self-examination and strategic calculation and trial and error and sacrifice that Bob just described. I mean, before they had Freedom Summer, they debated for months whether or not it was wise to bring in the white college students, whether they would overshadow the gains that were being made with difficulty by less educated black people in Mississippi, but also whether it would be fair to those white people, because they were in some sense were guinea pigs being brought down there, because the country would care when bad things happened to them, and when they weren't caring that they were happening to black folks. And Bob was raising questions, existential questions. How do you stop being a victim without becoming an executioner? So there will be profound things ahead if this movement deepens into something and makes use of this tremendous opening that we have here to fashion a turn in history and make something constructive out of the dislocation that is undoubtedly among us right now with the demonstrations and COVID on top of each other.
Let me just pick up on one point that Taylor made about guinea pigs. Because yes, that was the charge, and that was part of the conversation. But there was another conversation going on, which is who are the Americans, and what does it mean to be an American? And are you, does being an American mean that you are part of what's going on in Mississippi? And that coming down to Mississippi is in some sense establishing for the first time in your life, right, an experience about what it means to be an American that you had never dreamed of or anticipated, right? And that's what's happening to the country now, right? And so where will it take it and who will take it there?
Exactly. I think to me, what that means is that if the longer this movement lasts, the more certain it will be that everyone in it will have a different sense of what it means to be an American, based on the experiences that they go through trying to make change in this time. Bob, my memory is that the ultimate resolution to that question about whether it was fair and necessary to bring these white students out was that we have to assure ourselves that we are taking the same risk right alongside them, so that we can do this in good conscience and expand the notion of what it means to be an American back in a period of strict segregation.
Yes, actually, I think of that as part of the earned insurgency. Mm-hmm. In other words, we had earned the right to call on the young people in the country to come work with us.
Are we seeing that? But so this is then actually, I would say, additional cause for hope, right? Because one of the things that we saw in the protests in many American cities was protesters of many races. Actually, there were white protesters out there,
right,
as well.
Right.
So
right.
Perhaps that is a meaningful step forward.
Yeah, I absolutely. Yes, and we're watching to see if it keeps up, right? If it somehow, it can't sustain itself on the streets, right? It's got to look at, well, how do we get into actually working the system, organizing our people, right? How does that happen, right? At the grassroots, so that we develop a politics which is able to actually address some of these issues, right?
Yes, and there are incredibly hopeful signs. I just want to mention one quick thing, that last weekend, Saturday morning, my wife and I were sitting on our porch in the city of Baltimore, and all of a sudden down the hill through our neighborhood came marching children carrying Black Lives Matter signs. And there were at least 500 of them with adults, black and white, marching on a Saturday morning. The surprises continue, and I hope they grow wings.
Well, Taylor Branch is a Pulitzer Prize-winning writer and historian, author of many books, including the trilogy America in the King Years. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Bob, thank you. And Bob Moses, civil rights activist, field secretary for the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee in the 1960s, and one of the primary organizers of the Freedom Summer. Also, president and founder of the Algebra Project as well. Bob Moses, it's been an absolute honor to talk with you. Thank you so very much.
Thank you so much. Yes, same here.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.